Hi, I'm Steph, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 23rd, 2009. I have a home group, and I have a sponsor. And, you know, I thank God every day for that sponsor because, like it says in the first step, you know, my life's unmanageable, and I can't do it on my own. I can't make the simplest decisions, you know. Pretty much on the daily basis, I'll call my sponsor freaking out about something. She'll be like, have you eaten yet today? It's like you know, it's like probably 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll be like, no. I'll be like, all right, well, you know, go eat. And like, these are just simple little things, you know. Like, any normal person would be able to know, like, you know, probably by like 3 hours after they get up, they're probably pretty hungry. They need to eat, you know, or they need to get more than 3 hours of sleep. You know? But that's just the way I am. I'm an alcoholic. I can't manage the littlest things. So, I mean, it's obvious that I can't manage big things, you know. So, like, for me, I really need a sponsor, not just to show me, walk me through the steps, which is also, like, you know, real important to me because I can get things on an intellectual basis real easy. I can read the book and understand, like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. But then actually doing it, I need someone to show me how to do it because I will not motivate myself. But, you know, even beyond that, my sponsors taught me how to have a real relationship with people by learning to become honest with my sponsor and, you know, to not be afraid of her. She's taught me how to, like, really develop real connections with people, which is something I could not do when I was drinking. I couldn't be honest with people. I was never one of those people that was able to be like, no, I'm not okay. I told every single person in my life, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm one of those people, I could put a bullet in my foot, and I'm still fine. You know? But, you know, that's what I look for in a sponsor, someone who's patient and someone who can see through my BS. You know, I can tell her I'm fine, and she'll be like, all right, now. What's really wrong? Like, you know, she just absolutely knows. She can see right through me. And, you know, I need that because if I don't have someone who'll see right through me, I'll go the rest of my life pretending like everything's fine while I'm slowly dying inside. And I really just need someone to sit there and make me realize that I'm not okay and make me realize that I have problems. So she, you know, she really helps guide me with that. She helps me take a look inside. Because, as you know, most of us, I don't like to look at, you know, where I've gone wrong during the day. I don't like to, you know, see where I've been selfish or dishonest. But she does it in such a gentle and, like, loving way that I never feel like I'm under attack. I never feel like she doesn't have my best interest. I always know that no matter what she says, it always comes out kindly. And it's always that she just wants me to stay sober. And she just wants me to succeed in life. And, you know, I know every time I go on the phone with her that she's in my corner. And every now and then she has to remind me, you know. But there's never a feeling of, like, animosity between us. Like, she is actually the person I'm most comfortable talking with. You know, I'm not afraid to ask her questions, which is something I was terrified of before I came to AA. I could not ask someone a question. I couldn't show that I was not as intelligent or didn't get things the same way you did. But with her, she makes it real easy to just be like, I don't understand that. Can you explain it to me? And she will sit there and explain the same thing to me day after day after day. And she never grows tired of it. And, you know, that's what I need. I'm not a quick learner, you know. I like to do things the hard way. And, you know, when I asked her to be my sponsor, it was one of the things she said. She was like, you know, I'm not going to micromanage your life. I'll give you enough rope to hang yourself with. And that's just something that she understood about me, that I need to learn things through my own experience. You can tell me, you can warn me till you're blue in the face, but unless I feel that pain, I'm not going to learn. And she, you know, she understands that. And, like, that's just something that I really looked for in a sponsor, was just the patience and, you know, the ability just to deal with me, you know, and not make it seem like I'm a burden, because I'm one of those people that really will feel like I'm a burden real quick, and then I don't want to come talk to you. But she puts up with me, you know. I can call her anytime. She's never, you know, turned her back on me. I can show up at her door anytime, and that was another big thing that helped me, was that she invited me along, you know, to hang out with her, to go out with her friends, and seeing her relationship with other people really also helped me learn how to interact with other people. Like, I need to follow by example, and she, for me, is the one of the greatest examples of AA and the program, that how it works. You know, she has what I want, not just the material things, but the comfort and like just the contentment with life. I look at her and I can tell that on some deep inner level, like, she's okay with herself. And we've talked about it. You know, that's something I can ask her about, is like, how did you get through this? And she's one of those people that doesn't, you know, if she doesn't have experience on it, she'll tell me straight up, I don't have experience on it, but, you know, she'll help me find someone who does. She's never steered me wrong, and it took me a little while to realize she was never going to steer me wrong. But, you know, on the daily, I realized that, like, if I just listen to her and, you know, just trust her, I really can't go wrong, you know. Like I said, she just doesn't want to see me drink. She wants me to succeed in my sobriety. And so, you know, I'm very, very grateful that I have the sponsor I do today, and I keep close contact with her, and that's the greatest gift that, you know, I've gotten so far. It's just the ability to learn how to have real relationships and the guidance to walk through the steps. I can ask her any question about any step, and she'll, you know, she'll sit down and take the time. And, like, you know, like we say, time is one of, like, the most precious commodities. But she always has the time for me, and I love that. And so that's all I have to say. And here's our speaker tonight, Michelle. Michelle, I'm alcoholic. My sobriety is May 28th, 2007. I have a sponsor that a lot of you guys know, and I have a home group that a lot of you guys have been to. And I mean, without those things, there would be no reason I should be standing here. Like, that random girl, no program, you know. But I mean, I am very grateful for those things, and I did not feel that way when I first got here. I didn't understand the depth or the value in any of that. I didn't even really understand why I should be grateful to be sober. I didn't understand why people were talking about things like gratitude or like sobriety as if it was something to be desired. I felt like I hate myself. I hate my life. I can't drink. I can't not drink. Where's my solution? You know what I mean? Where's the solution for me at 3 o'clock in the morning when I can't sleep because my head's telling me I suck? Where's the solution for me when I'm trying to make small talk with someone and I physically can't put words out of my mouth because I am so consumed with fear? Where's the solution for me that my parents hate me? You know, where's the solution? What am I going to do? When am I going to learn to do my taxes? How am I going to get a job that I can show up for? I mean, how am I going to go back to school? I can't even sit in a classroom and think. You know, there's all these fears. And that's what I wanted a solution for. And I didn't see how drinking had anything to do with it at all. And, I mean, those fears I can recall having for as long as I can remember, really. You know, I mean, I remember being a little girl, and I don't know if, I mean, I'm sure there were times of happiness. You know what I mean? It's not like I had some tragic life story, you know, but I remember specifically times where I felt not a part of. You know, times where I felt, like, overwhelming dissatisfaction. You know, where I felt like I wasn't good enough. And where I felt like I couldn't make friends. Where I would look at other people and I would get jealous because it looked so effortless for them. It looked like they just knew. Like, they just knew what to do. They just knew what to say. And I didn't. And I knew I didn't. And I knew that made me not as good as them. And, you know, that's what I remember, you know, when I was little. And, I definitely carried that. I mean, that fear just kind of grew. Like, over time, I remember, you know, getting into middle school. And that's when I really realized that what people thought about me really mattered. It mattered. I mean, it mattered. It mattered more than anything. It mattered more than my grades. It mattered more than my family. It mattered way more than saving money on Kmart clothes. You know what I mean? It, like, really mattered. And that, I mean, that was my first purpose in life, the first one that I could actually work towards, you know, getting people to like me. And I really worked for it. And when I felt like I failed, I'd go home and I'd shake violently and I'd hurt myself, you know. And no one taught me that. It's just I didn't know what else to do, you know. And I knew that I couldn't deal. And I knew that tomorrow was going to be the same thing.
And I knew that, I just knew that there was no hope for me. Really, I knew that when I was that age. And, I mean, it was truly a blessing when I found alcohol. You know, and it wasn't even the alcohol at first. It was the thrill of getting out of myself by doing things that I knew I was not supposed to do. It was like, it was just the excitement and just going with the flow with these bad kids that didn't care what anyone else thought, and feeling the freedom, or at least hoping that I would get the freedom that they seemed like they had, you know, by just going along with them. And I mean, I didn't even care anymore. I didn't even have fear about it. You know, I was able to manipulate my parents really easily, you know, because I felt like it was worth it. You know, what we would do is we would go behind my house where there's woods and we'd smoke cigarettes. You know, and that turned into stealing my friend's dad's weed. And we'd go in the woods and we'd smoke his weed. And I loved it. And I really didn't think for a second that it was bad. I mean, I'd have these glimpses of, like, other kids aren't doing this. I mean, but I didn't care. You know, because it was, like, it was something that I could hold on to. You know, it was something that made me feel like maybe, just maybe, I had a purpose and a place in this world. Like, maybe if I'm good at this, which I was, you know, maybe then I can excel at something, you know. And I really did make it my purpose. And not every day, you know, there were still other things I was interested in. I always loved art. I always loved my sister. You know, I liked hanging out with my sister a lot. I had other things. It wasn't like it took over my life immediately. And I mean, I remember drinking every now and then just to impress people, you know, but it was never to get drunk. It was just because that's what they were doing, and I needed them to like me, because if they didn't, who was I? And, I mean, my first drunk experience was pretty much the epitome of all my drunks to follow. You know, I got alcohol poisoning. I drank a water bottle of 151. Ooh. I blacked out immediately. On the 2-minute walk to our friend's house from where we left, I had blacked out, hurt myself severely. And it was bad news. And we went to this, I mean, that was my freshman year of high school. And this party we were going to was the combined middle school kind of celebration party. So it was like all these new people I was supposed to be impressing, you know, like kind of coming together. And no one was drinking like that then. Nobody. I mean, and our friend's band was playing. They were all excited. Everyone's going to get to hear them. And they couldn't play because these two drunk girls, you know, it was me and my one other friend, and these two drunk girls ruined the party. And the ambulance came. It was parental supervised. And from that night on, you know, I was that girl you were not allowed to hang out with. And I mean, I did feel the remorse. I felt immense remorse, you know, the next morning when I realized what had happened. Because that was not my intentions. You know, my intentions were to drink more than these other stupid girls. My intentions were to just, like, impress people. That's all I wanted. You know, I didn't mean to black out and go to the hospital. And, I mean, my parents, they're good parents. I mean, there's nothing wrong with my family dynamics except me. And they ended up grounding me for 4 months. And I was like, okay, you know, I'll take responsibility for that. And 2 weeks later, I felt like I was going to kill myself. I felt like if I do not get out of this house, I will. I will have to kill myself. And I knew that was true, and I knew that feeling was real, because that's the way it always felt. I always felt like it was just a matter of time before I had to do what I had to do to get relief. And I didn't know that alcohol was the solution for that yet. I just thought my only option was suicide. And I knew that it was just a matter of time before that had to happen. Because I couldn't imagine going on the way that I felt and the things that I thought, which I knew were wrong. I knew they were wrong, and I couldn't imagine going on like that. And I really feel like alcohol saved my life. I respect the shit out of alcohol. It saved my life. I mean, it preserved my sanity long enough that I didn't have to kill myself. And that's the truth of it. And I mean, what happened was the only kids that were willing to hang out with me at that time were the kids who didn't care about my reputation, because they had the same one, if not worse. And and that worked out perfectly, because these were the kids who were doing what I wanted to do anyway. And I seemed to really be good at it. You know, I seemed to be really good at manipulating people. I seemed to be really good at getting what I wanted, and I seemed to be really good at drinking. And I seemed to be really, really good at smoking weed. And people started to like me for that. You know, and I'd never felt like anybody liked me before, ever. You know, I really felt like I had nothing to bring to the table in any social situation. I felt like, what's my purpose? Existing. You know, I didn't know. And this gave me something. And I really took to it. You know, and it was like the consequences started, you know, for my first drunk. I had really bad consequences, and they just kept evolving. And, you know, it started, I never was good at school. I never really felt that, like, natural drive to do well at school. You know, and, so it was kind of, like, not a big deal to me when I decided to stop doing anything academic. And I would show up occasionally, because you're supposed to, and what else was I going to do? But, I mean, when other kids started not going, I was the first one with them. You know, I was the first one willing to not go to school. And we would do that, and I started hanging out with people a lot older than me, because these people could get what I wanted. And, I mean, we would skip school, and we'd go to their house, and before I knew it, I started drinking at 7:15 in the morning. Because it's like I'd walk in the front doors and out the back, get in the car, go to their house down the street, crack open a bottle, and we get drunk. I'd be blacked out by noon. And I didn't think anything of that. You know, I just felt like I'm not by myself doing anything. There's people with me. There's no problem. You know, and there was no red flag, really. I mean, what I thought was the problem was when I wasn't drunk. It was when I was at home by myself. It was when I couldn't get the alcohol. It was when people weren't giving me the attention that I thought I deserved. You know, it was when people were ignoring me. It was when I couldn't think of the right words. That was the problem. It was not my drinking, and it was not the fact that I was blacked out at noon. And I definitely believe that. You know, if anything, I thought it was my smoking pot, because I love smoking weed. I would smoke weed all day, every day, because it was easily accessible. You know, I didn't see that at the time, but it's a lot harder to be manageable and drunk all day. It's a lot easier, you know, to just stay high. And the problem was that I just couldn't be in my own skin. You know, so it was really whatever. Whatever was the most available was what I was going to do. And, I mean, eventually I just stopped going to school entirely. And that was because I went to the psych ward. I mean, my parents... I had a big problem with myself when I was by myself. Bad things happened. The kinds of bad things that happened was I'd, you know, take out all that rage on myself, and because I didn't know what else to do. You know, I'd look in the mirror and I would think, I hate you so much. I would think, I wish you would die. And I would just, you know, express that rage in the best way I knew how. And you know, and I did. I got relief from that long enough. Psych ward. And I mean, my parents, they really wanted to help me. They really had high hopes for me. They really just wanted to find the right medication. They wanted to find the right therapist. They wanted to find the right diagnosis. And I did too. I really did. Because I would come home sometimes and my mom would shake me and she'd say, "What's wrong with you?" And she would look me in the eye and ask me that. And I would turn inward and I would think, "All right, Michelle, what's wrong with you?" And I would really want to know. I'd really ask myself that question, and I had no answer. And I wanted an answer real bad, because I couldn't tell you. And I knew it was something way bigger than anything my mom could help me with. And I knew it was something that was not going to get fixed in a pill. And I knew it was something that I wasn't able to touch. And I knew it was something that I couldn't even see or verbalize. And but I knew it was there, and I knew it was waiting to just take me over. And I felt insane all the time. I felt like maybe I'm schizophrenic. Maybe I'm just, like, on the verge of really going overboard, and this is just, like, the really awkward middle phase when you're, like, half crazy. That's really how I felt. I felt half crazy. You know, I had moments of, like, she might be okay. There was no hope. And, you know, but in the psych ward, I mean, I met kids a lot worse than me. I met a kid named Will who had another guy, Henry, in his head. And Henry would tell him to kill people he loved. And a week later, he wrote me a love letter. No, and I told him. And I just knew. I was like, I left there feeling pretty confident. Okay, you know? I thought, like, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm certainly not one of them. I mean, I just like to sit on the beanbag chair and watch Power Rangers. I could run from it. I could run from that question really fast and really hard. And I could stay messed up for as long as I could, as long as my supply would last me, as long as the people would go before they got sick of me. But it was like inevitably I had a moment where I had to sit with myself, where I had to be in my own skin. And it would be like I was on the medication. You know, I was seeing the therapist. I was doing all these things that they wanted me to do. And I still felt freaking crazy. I still felt a loneliness that I couldn't even describe and I couldn't express to my mom. And I couldn't express it to the therapist because she didn't understand. Because she kept telling me that if I stopped doing what I was doing, I would feel better. And I would think, you are crazy. That's not true. You know, because I have been sober. I have been just like doing what you want me to do and I'm still crazy. Bring me a tangible solution. Bring me a tangible diagnosis, please. And, I mean, the hopelessness inside of me grew. It grew really fast, and it grew every day that I existed. And, I mean, after that psych ward stint too, we decided that high school was my problem. Because I certainly couldn't function in it. It was the people. It was my bad reputation. It was the fact that I was a virgin. There's pictures of me on the bathroom stall doing disgusting sexual acts that I never did, you know, and I knew it was other people. I knew it was the school. I knew it was the school system. You know, I'm a free spirit. You know, I think it's all these man-made structures of authority holding me down. You know, I can't do it. You know, and I really believe that. I wrote some wild stuff on my Zenga. I was pretty sure that, I mean, and the best thing that I could come up with when I thought about what was wrong with me was that maybe, just maybe, I was like a star child. Or maybe, just maybe, like, I was some sort of, like, Gandhi. That was gonna blossom sometime in the near future. And it was just, like, all these trials and tribulations were just to prepare me, you know what I mean, for really giving out the word. And, you know, and that's the best I could come up with. And that actually, when I think about it now in hindsight, it was somewhat intuitive, you know, only because I knew that it was something spiritually wrong with me. I knew that it wasn't, like, just something that I could touch or something that I was going to be able to fix. I knew that it was something to my soul broken, and I knew that I was hopeless. And, I mean, after I dropped out of high school, my parents were like, oh, good, she can get a full-time job. She can get her GED, you know, go to college before all these kids. And I was like, I'm going to party every day. You know, I'll try and get a job, but if I don't like it, I'm not going. And, you know, that's exactly what I did. Because there was moments when I realized that just because my parents told me I was grounded did not mean that I had to stay home. And I realized that if I did whatever I wanted, what's going to happen? I'm not going to spontaneously combust. I'm not going to, like, in reality, nothing bad's going to happen. Because someday down the line, I'm going to be able to be like, look, I did turn out okay. And I did whatever I wanted. And that was my hopes. You know, because everything I did felt right. I mean, everything that I did was for a really good reason. You know, but what happened was, I mean, these outside circumstances absolutely got worse. You know, I mean, the drugs I started doing, you know, I kind of just kept pushing that line, you know, worse and worse. Kind of like my standards just seemed to lower themselves. And I was okay with that. And, I mean, the outside things, like I wasn't welcome in my home anymore. Because my parents just didn't know what to do with me. I mean, I'd go to these parties and I'd be this, like, fun girl. I'd be the girl that everyone wants to party with because she didn't care about anything. And then I'd go home and I would take it all out on my family. You know, I'd start hitting my mom. I would say things to my dad that no one should hear. You know, and I mean, I destroyed my family from the inside out. You know, and eventually I wasn't allowed there anymore. And they had given me plenty of ultimatums. And those ultimatums, I'm sure you guys are familiar with this, is change or get out. And I mean, for me, changing was not an option, and I knew that. And I knew that, I mean, if anything, I felt hope in that. Because I felt like, good, now I can do whatever I want. No one's watching me. Nobody. And I did that. And I mean, I really gave it my all, trying to do whatever I wanted. And unfortunately, what I want is self-destructive and drinking and hurting other people. You know, and it's never like that was my intention. You know, I never like really purposely, I mean, sometimes if I felt very justified about it, but I never like purposely was malicious. Like I never like made it a purpose to go out and hurt somebody, you know, or anything like that. I didn't think that I was a bad person. If anything, I thought I was opposite. I felt like I care about people. I understand people because of the pain that I feel. I can understand yours. You know, I had all these ideas about myself. Like, I was a good person. Like, it's just when everyone leaves me alone long enough to see it, that's when they're going to understand me. You know, that's when I'm going to be able to do all these great things that I think about doing every day. Sitting on the couch. And, I mean, my friends would get sick of me, these girls that I would hang out with, because the girls that I chose to hang out with were girls that drove, because I didn't drive, and girls with jobs, because I didn't have a job. And we were partners in crime. What that really meant was I was a taker. I was like the parasite in their passenger seat, you know, and I would just go wherever they went, and I would smoke their weed, and I would drink their alcohol, and I would do whatever else that they were doing. And, I mean, I was manipulative, I was cruel, and I didn't even know it. And because to me, I was just doing what I had to do. I was just doing what I wanted to do and what felt like the right thing to do. And I mean, I'd have moments of clarity, you know, when I'd be, like, leaning over the toilet. And I would think, like, how did this happen? I would think, like, things still aren't okay. And then I would just, you know, get up, look in the mirror, wipe myself off, and go back to doing what I was doing. You know, and it was almost like the more that I ran my life into the ground, the further from reality I got. It was like the more disconnected from conscience I became, and the more impenetrable I became. And I mean, I started getting in trouble with the police a lot more because I went in drug psychosis. And what happened then was I realized 100% that I was God. I was like, I found out that I am God, actually. And what that meant to me was that it was my duty now. I found my purpose. And it was my duty as God to tell other people about the spiritual evolution and battleground that they aren't even aware of. And this is actually when I lost a lot of friends. I would go to these parties, and you know, I would stare. There was usually one person a night that I designated the devil, and for whatever reason, and this one guy in particular is my. I was pretty convinced he was the devil. Still, in his sobriety, when I thought about him, I thought, you are the devil. I know it, and I put my cigarettes out on him. I would start fights with him. I would talk to him and, like, as if he was on the same page as me. But no one was. And people eventually were just like, she's crazy. Like, we can't hang out with her anymore. So I had to, like, skip around to people, you know. And I would give myself enough time with them that they couldn't get too sick of me. So I could always go back. And I would just bounce around from people to people. And the benefit in that, too, was that no one really saw how much I was drinking. No one really saw everything that I was doing. And because everyone was getting different Michelles. You know, there was no, like, consistent Michelle ever in my life, actually. And, I mean, the last time I got arrested, I was at a party of, like, 400 people in this big field party out in, yes, I don't know, only Maryland. And, I mean, the cops came, and I was like, this is my this is my chance. You know, this is my chance to, like, take down the system. And, I got up there, and I started screaming. They didn't even want to arrest anybody. They just wanted to break up the party. And, I mean, I got up there, and I started, like, you know, telling them what was really going on and the bigger purpose and the fact that their jobs were just man-made systems of authority, and don't they know that there's something way bigger out there? And they're actually going against that. And, and all this crazy nonsense. And, you know, and I remember, like, snippets of my friends being like, she's crazy. Just like, you know. And I remember, you know, they had finally, like, wrestled me into handcuffs. And I remember, like, staring at them, feeling so confident, like, they just don't even know. Like, they don't know. But I know my truth. And I was watching my friends on the sideline, like, laughing with the cops. Pointing at me laughing. And I was like, I'm all alone in this. And I was okay with that. I felt like, all right. All great leaders were alone. And, but that night, I mean, reality kind of broke through all that delusion. That night when, I mean, I was 17 years old. I was not an adult. So I got in the back of the cop car. They tried to take me home. And I remember sitting in the back of the cop car staring at my house. And I was telling them, my dad's not going to let me home. There's no point in us being here. He doesn't want to see me. He hates me. And I started telling him this sob story about how he hits me and he beats me and he's a horrible person. None of it's true. None of it. And I would tell people that stuff. You know, I remember, I mean, I had my friends convinced that my dad was this horrible, horrible man who had molested me, and that was the reason that I was the way I was. And that wasn't true. You know, I just needed something. I just needed a reason to feel as crazy as I did. I needed some tangible reason, because no one feels that crazy for no reason. It's just not possible. And I mean, I would lie all the time about stuff like that, and to the point I believed it. And I was telling these cops these things, and I mean, I think every now and then they'd feel sorry for me, but I don't think that was why. And I remember my dad coming the door and opening the door and looking at me, and he just shook his head and shut the door, you know. And I just, like, for one moment, I just felt, like, a little remorse. I just felt like, this isn't right. You know, and it wasn't even, like, a thought. It was, like, a feeling. It was, like, a fact. And, I mean, what happened was I ended up going to, after that, I mean, I really gave it my all to try and control my drinking. You know, because it was, like, I eventually became so physically sick and, like, so physically just ill, and I didn't know it was alcohol. I had no idea, but I was deteriorating. I couldn't eat anything. I couldn't drink anything. I was drinking gallons of milk because I thought that would help, and just drinking, you know. And it was never once that I think that alcohol was my problem. Still, you know, and it was crazy because it was like so many times in the past I had to tell myself, you know, why don't you just have a few tonight? Why don't you, like, try to control yourself? Why don't you not drink liquor? You know, why don't you not do what you did last night? You know, and it was, like, inevitably I always overshot the mark. Inevitably I got so drunk, and it seemed as if I changed my mind. You know, because when I did come to AA, I mean, I would hear people talk about being powerless, and I would think that's so dramatic. That is so dramatic. I mean, because I would picture, like, someone reaching for a bottle with one hand and the other hand trying to hold back. You know, and I would think, that never happened to me. You know, it's crazy. And I mean, the bitch about my alcoholism is that it talks to me in my own voice. And it tells me exactly what I need to hear so that I have to take a drink. Because what I don't know is that my head just wants me to get so lonely and so disconnected from you guys, from the rest of the world, that the only solution, the only thing that's going to give me any sense of relief or preserve my sanity is alcohol and the relief that that gives me. Because drinking was not just like something I did. Drinking was a spiritual experience for me that fixed my spiritual problem, you know, that I knew was there. And, I mean, after I got arrested, it was just more consequences, you know, but what happened was my insides became so dead and so void that I started to acknowledge it. I started to look at my life because I had nothing else to do. And, I mean, I had no sense of self-respect. I had no value for my own life. I mean, I wasn't welcome in my home, so I would do whatever I had to do to find a place to sleep, which meant I would, you know, hang out with these guys that had I had a sober decision in the matter, I wouldn't have. And, I mean, I'd watch the sun come up very often because I couldn't sleep, because if I slept, they would take advantage of me. And I knew that, but I remember feeling like that was okay because it was just what I had to do. And I remember feeling like there's no hope for me, and that's okay. You know, but what happened was when I really think that I was dead enough for something else to work in my life was when alcohol stopped working for me. In the sense that I had drank an entire 30-pack of Budweiser and some beer bongs and some other alcohol, and I knew that if I drank anymore, I was going to die. But my head was still as crystal clear telling me I sucked as it was when I was sober. And that was pretty hopeless because nothing was going to work now. And I knew that, and I felt defeated because I had tried to control my drinking without even knowing it. I had tried to fix my life so hard, and I couldn't. And that got me absolutely insane, and it got me absolutely with no family or no friends and completely alone. And, I mean, I called my mom one more time asking for help. It was the eighth time I'd gone to the hospital that month. She'd met me there every time, and I called her from Pennsylvania and told her that I was dying. And if she didn't meet me at the hospital, I was going to die. And when I got back, she met me at the hospital, and they admitted me in the psych ward again. And after that, they had all these, you know, continuing care plans for me, and I still used it after that. And what happened was I went to a rehab, and the rehab brought AA meetings in there. And I had no idea about AA, no idea. I had no idea about alcoholism. When I thought about alcoholics, I thought of old man under bridge in trench coat. And that surely was not me. I was 18 years old. I still felt like I had it going on. I felt like, you know, I can't be alcoholic. There's something wrong with me, but it's not that. It didn't even cross my mind. And, I mean, I told myself the last day in that rehab that if I didn't hear something that I related to, I was done. You know, there was no solution for me. And the last day I was in there, this guy came in and talked about things that I related to. He talked about the feelings and the thoughts of an alcoholic. And he talked about the reaction to alcohol, the fact that once I start, I can't stop, and the fact that I can't stay stopped. You know, because I tried to stay stopped. I tried a few times to get my life together and to do things, you know, how you're supposed to do them. You know, like get a job, do these normal people things, and I couldn't. You know, and I mean, eventually I found my home group today, you know, after I left there and decided that I would give AA a shot. And I mean, I heard people talking about the same stuff, you know, the feelings and the thoughts of an alcoholic. And that's what I relate to more than the reaction to alcohol, actually, because I couldn't really clearly see my drinking. And I still didn't believe that that was my problem because I knew it was something else. I knew it was deeper. And then, I mean, I remember making the decision to myself. You know, when you guys did the third step prayer earlier, I was thinking about my experience with that. And I mean, I really feel like it was when I realized that getting sober was going to mean changing my life, and that I was willing to do that. You know, that was my first kind of, like, surrender, you know, to anything else, to anything different. And it's taken me a long time to really understand my alcoholism to any degree. You know, I mean, I understand my reaction to alcohol. I understand that, you know, I'm especially negative, and I understand that I have an inability to form relationships with other people without the help of a higher power. And, I mean, even that being said, I still don't act like that all the time. You know, and I know for me that a lot of my conviction in having a first step has come from just not drinking. You know, from experiencing what happens to me when I just don't drink. And it's absolute hell. I mean, it is hell. It is like I mean, I really feel like the demons are after me. I really feel like it's only a matter of time and I get that impending doom that followed me around every day before I got sober. You know, and I remember, too, coming home from meetings for my first month and going to my room and hitting my knees and crying. Because I just was so grateful that there was something that maybe was going to work for me. And I was so grateful that God actually, I mean, that something actually had shown me another way to live. Because that's what I wanted. I didn't want to just stop drinking. I knew I needed a new way to live. I needed a new life. I needed a solution for the day. You know what I mean? I didn't need a solution from 8 to 9. I needed a solution for, like, everyday life. What do I do? How do I do these things? And, I mean, that's what alcoholics, I can't even do AA justice with my words for what it's given me, for what it's done for me. And I know in my experience that it's definitely contingent on what I'm giving to it, you know, on how much I'm trying to give it away. And, I mean, I've definitely, it's definitely ebbed and flowed. You know, there's been times where I'm just so content with my perfect life now, and I don't even want to, why should I talk to anyone else? I'm not crazy, you know? And, you know, but it's like spiritual law, you know? I will get crazy when I live for myself. And I mean, it's really like every day, I mean, it's just like I see something else about myself. You know, it's another area of my life that I can grow. You know, and recently it's been a lot of focus on my relationships with other people. You know, how I think of people, how I think of men. You know, I have a lot of old ideas about men. And, you know, it's been evident in my inability to form relationships with other people. Just in friendships. I don't mean in, like, you know, boy-girl relationships. But, I mean, I have to act as if AA is a place for men and women. You know, this isn't just, like, I mean, a place like, you know, I mean, and I am grateful that I have a sponsor who helps me through those things, you know, who shows me this path and who's done it and who keeps a close eye on me and who wants better for me in every area of my life. And I don't know, I'm really grateful that I can be here with you guys. We had a lot of fun coming up here, and I'm sure it's going to be a little more tiring on the way back. But, I mean, I am grateful that I got to come here and be a part of your guys' home group meeting. So I really appreciate you having me here and for listening. So thanks.